Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Antonio Dr. Antonio Ragopoulos, who is professor of Sanskrit language and literature at the University of Venice in Italy. Antonio, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks. Thanks a lot for inviting me.
Yeah, so we'll be speaking about fairly fascinating new publication, SUNY 2021 publication called The Hagiographer and the Avatar, The Life and Works of Narayan Kastur. So 30,000 foot view, you know, How did you get into this field of research? I mean, maybe we should say a quick note that you study a particular movement, a particular figure, and their hagiography. But tell us about the journey of how you got into this long lived research interest of yours.
Well, I first got interested in the so-called Sai Baba movement in my university days when I was an undergraduate. And I was very much interested in Indian gurus and saints at the time. And my professor of Indian philosophies, Mario Piantelli, suggested that I should tackle the study of perhaps one of the most popular Indian saints in modern India and contemporary India. And that was Sai Baba of Shirdi. In fact, I realized very soon that the popularity of Sai Baba of Shirdi was indeed extraordinary in the whole of India. So that prompted me to read and to study more than I could on this figure. And eventually this brought me to India for my first field research. That was back in October, November of 1985 for my BA thesis, really, which was about the life and teachings of Shirdi Sai Baba. And of course, dealing with the life and teachings of Shirdi Sai Baba, I was also intrigued by the figure of what was then the contemporary Sai Baba, that is the one that was considered to be in a way his reincarnation, that is perhaps the better known Satya Sai Baba of Puttaparthi, who has been quite popular and is still quite popular in the West, who was born in Andhra Pradesh and lived in the village of Puttaparthi in the state of Andhra. In fact, Shirdi Sai Baba, I forgot to say, hailed from the village of Shirdi precisely, which is not far from Bombay in the state of Maharashtra, whereas the Satya Sai Baba practically lived and established his own ashram in Puttaparthi, the village where he was born in 1926, which is in the state of Andhra Pradesh. So in a way, one thing brought me to the other. And along the years, I've been constantly searching and studying both saints, both Sai Baba of Shirdi and Satya Sai Baba Puttaparthi, who in fact died recently in 2011. And of course, there are also various other figures that are connected, especially with Shirdi Sai Baba, which are considered important in and of themselves. But basically, this is what brought me to study the Shirdi Sai and Satya Sai movements. It was something that originated during my undergraduate years back in the 80s, and it was prompted by my BA thesis.
I actually had the good fortune of doing some advanced Sanskrit training in Pune in, I think this was 2012, which of course is in Maharashtra. And while there, I certainly came to learn of the enormous impact, relevance of Shirdi Sai Baba. And another fascinating figure that we could talk about a bit later in the podcast, which is this deity Dattatreya. Enormous following in Maharashtra. And of course, I was engaged in textual study, but I couldn't help but do a little bit of armchair ethnography while I was there. So yeah, huge, huge figure. Say a bit more. I mean, there will be listeners who are very well acquainted with Satya Sai Baba, perhaps even part of that movement. And there will be those in a more generalist audience who may not have as much exposure to him. So could you say a little bit more about his life or impact or following?
Well, as I said, he was born in 1926, and he presented himself at the age of 13 or 14 as being the reincarnation of the Shirdi Sai Baba. So in fact, this was the claim he put forward when he was a teenager, and he established his own authority and guruship mainly through his charisma, that is, through his alleged powers. That is what made him especially famous around Andhra Pradesh and later throughout India and even beyond India, the fact that he was considered a great miracle worker. And by the way, this was also the main reason for the fame of the Shirdi Sai Baba, in fact, because even Shirdi Sai Baba was in fact a charismatic, that is, he was a saint that was considered capable of offering to his followers, to his disciples, both bhukti and mukti, as they used to say, that is, both worldly enjoyments, that is, health and prosperity, as well as liberation from the cycle of rebirths and redeaths. So in a way, this also ties the Satya Sai Baba and Shirdi Sai Baba with the Dattatreya issue that you mentioned, because of course, most Indians, most Hindus believe that both Shirdi Sai Baba and later devotees of Satya Sai Baba also think that both gurus, in fact, are reincarnations or manifestations, better said, avatars, manifestations or descents on earth of the god Dattatreya, that is considered a kind of eternal avatara, the kind of exemplary guru, yogin, and avatara all in one. So as you said, the figure of Dattatreya with the three heads is very, very popular, ubiquitous all over, especially Maharashtra, but he's also very popular in the whole of South India. So devotees regard both Shirdi Sai and Satya Sai as avataras of Datta or Dattatreya.
So before asking a question particular to the book, I can't help but ask a little bit more about this Dattatreya figure. You say some fascinating things in one of the later chapters of your book about the potential, what I think of as Puranicization of this figure. Could you say a bit about that now in terms of who this figure is or how they're presented in the Puranas, or perhaps about your conjecture that, you know, perhaps this was originally a tantric deity. Could you tell us a bit about
Dattatreya? Dattatreya is originally a Puranic deity. The Markandeya Purana and Bhagavata Purana have important, significant tales about him. He is presented as a great lord of yoga and teaching yoga to his disciple Alarka, for instance. He's also considered as the kind of prototypical teacher or guru. And he was soon viewed as one of the many descents on earth, avatars of Vishnu. In fact, in the Bhagavata Purana particularly, he is listed in a list of the 22 avatars of Vishnu. So although he's not in the famous list of the 10 major avatars, still Datta or Dattatreya, as he's called, is still considered a descent of Vishnu. The name means that he comes from Rishi Atri, because Atri was his father. So he is the given to Atri. He was given as a boon to Rishi Atri. And that's where the name comes, Datta or Dattatreya. Datta meaning given is the past participle. So this figure becomes more and more important in the Marathi cultural area in Maharashtra, especially during the Middle Ages, the Middle Age period, particularly from the 12th century, I would say, with the emergence of important movements of ascetics like the Mahanubhavas, but also the Varkari. And finally, what makes Datta or Dattatreya perhaps the most popular deity in Maharashtra is a 16th century text known as Guru Charitra, which presents the life of two saints, Shripada Shrivallabha and Narasimhan Sarasvati, who are considered to be the first two historical avatars of Datta. Now, this text, known as Guru Charitra, which means the life story of the gurus, of the teachers, has been very, very popular along the centuries, is still very important and very popular. And it is precisely the Guru Charitra and these two seminal saints that has given rise to the so-called Datta Sampradaya, that is the tradition of the Datta or Dattatreya followers, which has also many sub-branches, because it has expanded along the centuries, and it's still alive and well. And there are various offshoots and branches of the Datta Sampradaya, not only in Maharashtra, but also in neighboring states. So the cult of Datta within the Datta Sampradaya, but also more popularly as an icon in and of itself with its own temples, is very widespread throughout Maharashtra, I would say. He's with the Ganapati, with Ganesha, he's probably one the most revered or popular deity in Maharashtra. And this perhaps is also the reason why a particular saint like Shirdi Sai Baba was assimilated to him. And also later on, eventually even Satya Sai Baba Puttaparthi was assimilated to Datta, because even in the Datta cult, he's famous for performing all sorts of chamatkar, that is miracles, and of, as I said, granting both worldly enjoyments as well as liberation, moksha or mukti. So there are various reasons theologically for linking Dattatreya to these saints of modern and contemporary India, or at least Hindus have assimilated them to the icon of Dattatreya.
Thank you for indulging the Purana question. Well, it's one of my primary fields of research. And of the Puranas, the Markandeya is the one I've spent the most time with. My work primarily is on the Devi Mahatmya and the Sanskrit epics, but the Markandeya Purana, above and beyond the presence of the Devi Mahatmya, the Markandeya Purana I find utterly fascinating. There's something there that I can't quite put my finger on. So thank you for indulging that question. Now that we've set the stage and we've talked about the avatar, the title of the book is The Hagiographer and the Avatar. So who's the hagiographer? What's the book about?
I try to look at the life and teachings of Satya Sai Baba from a different angle. That is, I focus on the hagiographer, that is this figure of Narayan Kasturi, who was an eminent intellectual, a professor, and a really remarkable figure, also especially a novelist and a humorist, in fact, who in 1948 became a follower of devotee of Satya Sai Baba. Narayana Kasturi in 1948 was around 50, and he became a devotee of a very young guru who was only in his 20s. Which is also kind of curious. But anyway, Kasturi was a very religiously inclined person. He was in the mainstream of a Vivekanandian outlook on religion. In fact, he had been a very close devotee to Ramakrishna and Vivekananda. He was part and parcel of the Ramakrishna mission for many years. At a certain point, however, he got into the Satya Sai in a way network of things. That is, he had darshan of Satya Sai Baba in Bangalore back in July, I think, 1948, and that was in a way what changed his life, because he became an ardent devotee of Satya Sai Baba and ended up living at his ashram and spending practically his whole second life, in a way, at his feet at Puttaparthi. And in fact, he became his secretary, his right-hand man, and the main hagiographer. That is, he wrote what is considered to be the sort of Bible or Guru Charitra, if you wish, of all Satya Sai Baba devotees. This text in four parts or installments, which is called Satyam Shivam Sundaram, which presents the life of Satya Sai Baba from his birth up to the year 1979, actually. In fact, it was Satya Sai Baba himself who, on their first meeting, asked him or told him that he would write his own Jiva Charitra, his own the book of his life. And he was really startled at this observation, because he really didn't know anything about the saint, the young Satya Sai, at that very first meeting. But in fact, it came to be true, and he became the saint's right-hand man. And I would say he lived from 1950 up to his death, which happened in 1987, practically he lived his whole life day by day with Satya Sai Baba, spending many hours with him every day. So he was a major figure in the movement. And I'm in this book, I try to look at Satya Sai Baba through Kasturi, through his books, through his main hagiography, and also through all the various activities that, as secretary at the ashram, he dealt with and he organized. And so he was a major, major figure. And since nobody had really focused on Kasturi's figure before, I thought that this was most interesting to do.
Does the book primarily illumine the hagiographer, the avatar, or both?
I think both, in the sense that I follow the life of Narayan Kasturi from birth to death. So also before he became a devotee of Satya Sai Baba, in order to contextualize where he came from, who he was, what were his activities, and religious feelings and culture overall. And of course, when he becomes a devotee and a follower of Satya Sai, his life changes. And by studying his production, his literary production, because after all, Narayan Kasturi was first and foremost a litterateur, and he wrote extensively both prior to his meeting Satya Sai as a novelist and after meeting him as a devotee. So his production, especially Satyam Shivam Sundaram, the main hagiography, but also his other books on the Guru Puttaparthi are fundamental in order to try to understand the Guru's figure. Because in fact, Kasturi was a theologian in and of himself. And so studying Kasturi's works and theology is a way to also get in touch with what was Satya Sai Baba's own perception of himself, or the way he wanted to be presented, because the two were strictly interacting among themselves, and Kasturi would not do anything without the Guru's permission. But at the same time, he had, in a way, the freedom to deepen and his theological understanding of the saint, having got his approval through his many books. So in a way, the two of them contributed to the creation of a sort of unified canon of what it entailed to be a devotee of Satya Sai Baba, and more importantly, what Satya Sai Baba thought about himself theologically. And so in a way, publicized, widespread, this kind of gospel of Satya Sai in terms of a cosmopolitan cult in India and even beyond India. Because what is important to notice is that although Kasturi, before knowing Satya Sai, wrote in Kannada mainly, after meeting Satya Sai and becoming his secretary, shifted to English and wrote practically all of his books on the Guru in English, precisely to spread this movement and to make it more and more international.
Could you say a bit more about Satya Sai Baba's influence over his own hagiography, the extent to which he was curating controlling the narrative in some sense?
To be sure, he was controlling the narrative, but at the same time, I think there was also an influence of Kasturi in a way over Satya Sai, although to be sure, Satya Sai controlled whatever Kasturi did or wrote. Still, there was a kind of interesting mechanism there of the kind of interchange between saint and hagiographer, which is another most interesting issue because, as you know, often hagiographers or the main hagiographers write about the lives of the saints they're interested in after their death. In many cases, we read these accounts of the lives of saints from people who write about them. Many of them, of course, are devotees. In fact, these are hagiographies, but after the saint passed away. Here we have a case of a hagiographer that was inspired by the Guru, who wrote about him extensively for around 30 years, and who had daily link with him. And so it is a very interesting hermeneutical circle in a way, because they both shared a kind of Vivekanandian neo-Hindu context and outlook. So in a way, I would say that they were very similar, in fact. And even prior to becoming a devotee of Satya Sai, in a way, Kasturi shared that same cultural and religious perspective. So it was easy for him to shift in a way from Ramakrishna to Satya Sai Baba. It was not a big, step after all. And Satya Sai Baba himself, in a way, shared that whole neo-Hindu Vivekananda outlook.
What do you think the hagiography accomplished? What work did it do or does it do? And also maybe comment on what do you think its intent was, whether or not those align or not. You know, what does it accomplish or what was it intended to accomplish?
Well, what he wanted to accomplish was to present Satya Sai Baba as the avatar of the age and being a post-sectarian figure that could be palatable and acceptable by all faiths, beyond the Hindu religion, and in a way universalizing his figure by presenting him in a way as the consummation of Christianity, of Buddhism, of Judaism, and of course of Islam and Hinduism. In a way, Kasturi's aim was to universalize Satya Sai Baba as the God-man for the whole of mankind, beyond sectarian dogmas and institutionalized religions. And so theologically, even the figure of Datta, in a way, he utilized as a tool for, in a way, transcending even the Hindu roots of Satya Sai and of Datta himself in a kind of spiritual impulse or effort to present him as a kind of universal savior and avatar beyond Hinduism or India. And this is the reason why he wrote his Satyam Shivam Sundaram and all his other books in English, fundamentally. And this project, of course, was shared by Satya Sai, so that Satyam Shivam Sundaram, that is the major opus of Kasturi, that is regarded still nowadays by all followers as the Bible for all Satya Sai devotees, Satyam Shivam Sundaram presents the life of the saint from his birth up to 79, which is a kind of presentation of the major happenings in Satya Sai Baba's life. But of course, the miraculous element is all over, so that it's practically impossible to separate the supernatural or the miraculous element from the presentation of the biography of the guru's life. So it's really a mishra, an inextricable mixture of devotion, of miraculous accounts, and of history and of his biography, as any hagiography is, after all. So in this sense, it is not very different from many other charitras or hagiographical accounts of modern and contemporary India. But I think the project was the agenda was that of presenting Satya Sai Baba as a cosmopolitan post-sectarian master guru that could be appreciated and followed and loved throughout the world beyond one being Christian, Muslim, or Hindu for that matter. So this was basically the project.
Was that agenda Kasturi's or Sai Baba's or both?
I think both, absolutely. They both share this focus and this agenda. I think in this sense, they collaborated with one another and reinforced one another. Satya Sai Baba, through his daily miracles and charisma, and through his darshans and many discourses and teachings, and Kasturi mainly as a theologian and as a biographer of the saint. So the two reinforced each other. But I think that to understand Satyasai, it is absolutely essential to dive deep in Narayana Kasturi's life and literary production.
What do you make of, or how do you account for, Kasturi's draw, this journey of meeting this fairly young guru at the time, and in short order giving his life to that individual, becoming presumably a close confidant, bhakta, devotee, an officiary, a secretary. You know, what do you make of that?
Well, that was a big break, in fact, in Kasturi's life. It happened at the time of a crisis, which I think is significant. That is, as I was saying, Kasturi was always a very religiously inclined person. He was part of the Ramakrishna mission, and he shared that Vivekananda outlook and culture. So he was pretty much part and parcel of his own times, of course. And he was very much into the Ramakrishna mission and activities. At a certain point, however, two major things happened that determined the crisis in his life. That was the death of one of his sons. In fact, he got typhoid. And it was a very traumatic, of course, experience for him, and the whole family was a tragedy, and that, in a way, determined a big change in him. And the other factor was the marriage of his daughter, that he tried to organize, and he had all sorts of problems in doing this, and finally. The bridegroom he selected eventually he succeeded in having him marry his daughter, and he turned to be linked to Satya Sai Baba because their family was devoted to Satya Sai Baba. So he got in a way linked to Satya Sai Baba through the marriage issue of his daughter. And in the beginning, he was totally against Satya Sai Baba because miracles usually were not viewed, were not considered important or viewed benignly by the Ramakrishna mission. In fact, Vivekananda was very harsh concerning Godmans that emphasize the miraculous, and the Ramakrishna mission has always been very, very somber regarding these issues. So in the beginning, he was even against the idea of meeting this young guru. On various occasions he refused to go see him, but eventually it so happened that I would say out of curiosity he finally decided to go take a look and meet this young Swami in Bangalore that as I said happened in July 1948, and this meeting was really fundamental for him. In fact, it was actually the second meeting. It was not really the one very first meeting, but in any case, it was the first occasion when he was close to him and could have an interaction also beyond the darshan. That is, he could have even a short conversation with the young Swami. And this was really something extraordinary for him because it was a fundamental experience that shattered all his doubts and criticisms. And he became really a bhakta of Satya Sai Baba, I would say, precisely at that very meeting in Bangalore. And from 1948, his whole life changed. And he decided eventually to transfer himself to live in Puttaparthi. First, he organized the marriage of his of his daughter Padma in Puttaparthi, following the guru's instructions that she could get married in Puttaparthi. And later on, he decided to live there with his family and became an inmate of the ashram from the early 50s and for the rest of his life.
Fascinating. Do you want to say a bit about the structure of the book?
Well, as I said, the book follows Kasturi's life. So the first chapter is dedicated to the early formative years of Kasturi, up to the time when he first meets Satya Sai Baba and his life is in a way transformed. Then I focus on his major work, that is Satyam Shivam Sundaram, that had a long period of gestation and preparation, many, many years of dedicated research by Kasturi, who after all was a professor of history in university at the time. So as I said, Kasturi was a brilliant intellectual, a great humorist. And in fact, he was a very popular figure of Kannada literature. Even to this day, Kasturi's books in Kannada are extremely popular. He wrote extensively in Kannada. But so in second and third chapters, I look at this main work of his, Satyam Shivam Sundaram, that is divided in four parts. So in chapter two, I basically look at the first two parts. And in chapter three, I look at parts three and four. Then I present in a further chapter, his other works concerning the Guru of Puttaparthi. This is chapter four. Chapter five has an interview I was able to record with Kasturi back in November of 85, just 2 years before he died. Kasturi had a long life. He was born in 1897 on Christmas Day, and he died on August 14 of 1987. So when I interviewed him in November 85, he was very old, of course. He was very frail, but we had a very nice and long conversation. In fact, during that trip, I had been for several weeks in Shirdi, interviewing old villagers of Shirdi for my BA thesis, as I was telling you in the beginning, and then went to Puttaparthi because I also wanted to interview people about Satya Sai Baba, and I ventured to meet and have some long conversations with Kasturi. So chapter five is dedicated to a presentation of these materials, this interview, and an analysis of his words and the conversations we had, especially seeing Kasturi as a theologian, and also the Dattatreya paradigm that in fact is basic to this interview as well. So then following this, I precisely present Satya Sai in the light of Dattatreya, that is taking the theological presentation of Kasturi and in a way expanding it and trying to understand it, probing it further. So chapter six is dedicated to a presentation of the Dattatreya theology concerning, I would say, the Satya Sai Baba movement, because I consider both Shirdi Sai as a predecessor and Satya Sai as the contemporary one. Then chapter seven is the closing years of Kasturi's life. So the last years of his life where various issues are important. He writes some two, three final books, very important, that he writes around these late last years of his life. And I try to present a narrative of his last days because they are important also to understand the significance of Kasturi within the ashram and for all the devotees and the Satya Sai organization. And finally, I have an epilogue where I kind of try to have a balance of Kasturi's life and activities, and trying to argue that the major issues that he was involved with, his legacy, in other words, lived and lives on. And I tackled the issues of darshana. I tackled the issue of mass mediatic darshana in particular, the issue of seva, which is very important in the movement, that is service, which is, I would say, the most important essential element of the teaching of both Sai Babas, that is service to humanity through schools, education, hospitals, and many other activities. And of course, the third element, which has to do with this universal theological message, this universalism, which was already there in Shirdi Sai Baba, especially through the Hindu-Islamic integrative mysticism. But of course, with the Puttaparthi Baba, becomes even more universalized in a perspective that goes, as I was saying, beyond even institutionalized religions, a kind of post-sectarian movement and devotion. So I tried to investigate the links between the two sides, but also the differences and the development theologically that takes place moving from one to the other, precisely by looking at Kasturi's works and narratives.
What most surprised you or stayed with you in terms of your study of Kasturi?
Well, to tell you the truth, what originally prompted the book were precisely these conversations, these interviews I had with him, because for many years I had just them lying here in on my desk, and I had not really made much use of them. And it eventually dawned on me that these materials were precious, because after all, they were kind of one of the last testimonies of Kasturi, and I thought that they needed to be studied in depth and shared and made available. So that, in a way, was what prompted this book on Kasturi, because working on these conversations, I realized the import of his theology and the importance again of Dattatreya within this whole perspective. And so I started planning this study, which took several years, by working on the life of Kasturi from the beginning, and trying to see throughout his life, and by probing into his literature, the way in which he appropriated, in a way, the guru, and presented him to the vast public of devotees or people interested in Sai Baba. Because after all, millions of people have read Satyam Shivam Sundaram or the books of Kasturi. Kasturi is like a legend for all bhaktas and devotees, both in India and abroad, so that his importance, in a way, was second only to the gurus. Kasturi was considered to be, in a way, the mediator between Satya Sai Baba and the followers. So he, in this sense, he was an extremely important figure and a remarkable figure to study and to focus upon. So having said this, of course, I would have never ventured into this book if the production of Kasturi had not been in English, because I could have never done this if he had written in Telugu or Kannada, because these are languages that I took some lessons, and I have kind of introductory background in Telugu, but I cannot actually read it fluently or speak it. So I ventured into this project because I thought I could, approximated through the medium of English, precisely because this was the language that Kasturi decided very consciously to utilize in order to expand the fame and greatness of his hero, in a way.
Fascinating. With respect to the interview that you include in chapter 5, They're also included in another work of yours. You want to say a bit about that?
Well, the point is that, again, during the COVID pandemic, I had all these old interviews that I had done in Shirdi back in 85. And I had also never published them separately. I had written a book on the life and teachings of Shirdi Sai Baba back in the 90s. And I had utilized partially these testimonies, but I had never never thought of publishing them in their entirety. So what dawned on me is was that after all, these interviews I had taken in Shirdi were with old villagers of the Shirdi saint. That were the last testimonies of people who had actually seen and had an exchange with the Shirdi Sai Baba, because I was able to find seven or eight people living in Shirdi and the whereabouts that had actually seen and talked to Shirdi Sai Baba. So what I decided to do was to, in a way, transcribe all the interviews in English and have them preceded by excerpts from my diary of the time, so as to contextualize these interviews and present what had been my fieldwork originally back in October, November 85. So even to present in a way what Shirdi looked like back in the mid of the 80s. Shirdi has grown tremendously in these three decades, and today is one of the major pilgrimage sites of India, as you know. But back in the 80s, things were very different. So I decided to publish these transcripts and also the original audio recordings. I published them through an open access press, which is the Venice University Press of my university. And so it's really for free, and anybody can download these conversations, this book, and the various audio recordings of the various people I interviewed day by day. And the Kasturi interview being part, the final part of this whole set, I decided to include that as well, being in a way kind of comprehensive of all the meetings and interviews I had done for that field research. So I just hope that both people who are interested in the Sai Baba movement or devotees of Shirdi Sai especially might be interested in hearing the voices of these old villagers and perhaps read also the transcripts of their words. And so this other book is called Oral Testimonies on Sai Baba, and is precisely this account of my field research back in 1985 in Maharashtra, basically, and then for some time in Andhra.
Fantastic. We will.
I can send you the link if you're interested, or perhaps you already have it, because I had sent you the link to this other book. If any of the people who are listening to us would be interested in viewing it or downloading it, it's for free, so anybody can download it.
Indeed, I was just about to say that we will in fact include the link in the podcast notes. So anyone who's listening to the podcast on whatever platform, just click on the link in the notes, and you will have that fascinating publication at your fingertips. Excellent. Thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot to you. Bye.
For those listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Antonio Rigopoulos of the University of Venice on a fascinating new publication, The Hagiographer and the Avatar, The Life and Works of Narayan Kasturi. And I'm, of course, your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. You can find out more about my work at rajbalkaran.com or study with me online at courses.rajbalkaran.com. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, and keep contemplating avatars such as this. Take care.